Well, last week, KPCW interviewed writer Mark Peruzzi about his article, The Giant Resort Companies You Hate Are Saving Skiing. Today, writer Bridget Mander has a different take on the topic, and she submitted her response to Outside Magazine. It's titled, Actually, the Mega Season Pass is Killing Skiing. She joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Bridget.
Good morning, Leslie.
So as we had reported, Mark Peruzzi saying that the resort conglomerations have saved ski towns. And he basically told us if you don't like the crowds, the expensive housing and the stagnant wages, you can always move. But you wrote something in response to him saying that core skiers, the people who live in ski towns, aren't happy that gigantic business interests seem suddenly aligned. You know, can you talk a little bit about why you were prompted to write this?
Well, yeah, I of course read Mark's article, and he's written lots of great stories for skiers and for the outdoor industry over the years, but I was taken aback. I definitely disagreed with it, and so, yeah, I talked to the editors at Outside, and they agreed that a rebuttal would be a good thing, and part of the reason why I disagreed with it so much is because it seemed like, to me, it's nothing more than marketing hyperbole. They're big companies. They have a job to do. I don't fault them for that. But it doesn't mean that it aligns with someone who lives in a ski town or even your lower middle class or just middle class skiers. Skiing is, despite this pass, like, skiing is getting more expensive for your overall visitor, and that is supported in many statistics. At least in the United States and North America. This doesn't actually apply to Europe and other parts of the world. But and it's part of the, it's adding a lot of pressure to what people who live in mountain towns, like a lot of people in Park City, of course, I'm sure would identify with this. There's already a crunch. And so the mega passes are adding more pressure, more tourists, more visitors. And it's straining infrastructure, it's straining the capacity of employees, and nothing's getting better, like no costs are going down for anybody. So I fail to see how this is really helping anyone, except for, like, basically the major companies. And that's fine, that's their job, but I don't have to agree that it's helping me as a skier.
Right. But I was going to say, probably the businesses are on Main Street are probably pretty excited, too, just to have more people in their shops and restaurants as well.
I suppose you could say that, but as a double-edged sword, a lot of small companies can't maintain employees because nobody wants to live somewhere where they're getting paid $12, $15 an hour and your rent is $1,200 a month. Like, that doesn't work that well for a small business. Like, they have a capacity, at least a lot of small businesses that I have spoken to have trouble. They have trouble maintaining quality employees. They have trouble maintaining people for more than sometimes not even a full season, because people give up. And then they may be replaced at some of the larger companies by J-1 visa holders, which isn't great if you are thinking about maintaining your actual community, your town.
Yeah, we've got kind of a big debate going on here. Park City Mountain Resort traditionally closes the second weekend in April, and they announced their closing season, of course, when the season started back in November. People complaining, though, oh, they're closing early. Their response is, no, we're not closing early. You knew when we were closing. But traditionally, it is open another week. Part of that, though, what we're hearing is that they just don't have the employees to work it. And again, you know, with many of the J-1 workers gone for the season, that they're not able to maintain that traditional closing. Are you seeing that in other areas as well?
You know, I haven't followed up on that. I have heard that in past years, and I certainly wouldn't be surprised. You know, like a lot of this resort areas, because your average ski bum who's American doesn't want to work under those conditions, they bring in the J-1 workers, which is technically a cultural exchange visa, not like a cheap like labor exploitation. But I've heard that, and yeah, I mean, I certainly couldn't comment on Park City, but I wouldn't be surprised. And this is the price people are paying for. I mean, it's not even cheaper. Like, your hotel's not cheaper because you have a cheap labor, like a J-1 working there. So the benefit to you as the visitor, I don't see it personally. Does that answer your question? I'm not sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I know it's hard to speculate. Yeah. But let's talk a little bit about, do you think skiers are complaining about the mega passes because it makes the sport more accessible to casual skiers?
No. See, I think that, I don't know, that's very narrow. And I suppose what I thought with Mark's article was that it had a very narrow take on it. This impacts a lot of aspects of a town. So if you want to keep something functioning as a town as opposed to just a giant resort where, you know, nobody, it's not actually a functioning town and you don't have to count on any of those services or quality of life that you would normally get in a town, that's one thing. But the passes, you know, I live in Jackson, and I actually pitched this article before this season, before people just, like, lost it over the Icon Pass here. But it was really, really crowded. And I don't even blame the Icon Pass holders themselves. Like, they're like, oh, great deal. I'm going to go to Jackson. And I think that the hope is that they'll stay in all the hotels and they'll spend all their money at the restaurants. I'm not sure that actually happened. But ultimately, like, there's a point where your quality of life is so impacted by more visitors. Like, do you care that the sandwich shop is busier or that the resort is making more money? And who is that actually benefiting?
Yeah, and I think this year in particular, it's really hard to guess what brought the skiers out. Was it the Icon Pass there in Jackson, or was it just the great snow?
That's a question. I obviously couldn't. I wish that I had been able to interview, or they had people checking boxes as they showed up. I think it's part of the cachet for us personally of all of a sudden Jackson being on this massive pass. A lot of people, I read a lot of articles that were saying, oh, I bought it because I saw Jackson on there. But I mean, I don't want to make this only about Jackson, because Jackson is not the only town to have. Basically, what it did is exacerbate all the pressures that all these little towns are already struggling with, which are absolute lack of housing, almost no affordable housing, lack of even overpriced housing, and the expansion of tourism industry jobs, which are traditionally very low paying. So that doesn't, like, those things don't bode well for the future of a town. In towns with strong governments, I think local government has a lot to say in this. Personally, when I talked about how very large, the larger, more powerful a company is, the harder it is for a town to try to protect itself, as evidenced in the case that I talked about in the article, an anecdote I find to be amusing, but it's a serious one also, of Summit County, Colorado, and Vail brings in an enormous amount of people, pays them incredibly low wages, and the town is already struggling with huge traffic problems, huge housing problems, huge labor shortages. So I don't see how this is good for skiing.
Let's talk a little bit more about housing. You mentioned in the article that housing prices are up in resort towns affected by the passes. I mean, Jackson, it's always been, I think, really difficult to find housing. But tell us specifically about what you heard in Big Sky. Again, this is another one of those towns that was added to one of the passes.
Yes. Well, Big Sky is almost a different case, I feel like, but it's still interesting because it was founded around a resort like Vail was, but much later. Actually, not that much later, but and the town grew up around it. And that town is owned, has a huge influence by Cross Harbor Capital, which owns a lot of the developable land, and it's set out for, you know, these huge luxury, you know, allocations like the Yellowstone Club, Moonlight Basin, Spanish Peaks. And then you have a little part of town where they can try to house, like, an actual community. And I think it's really hard for those people. They have no local government to look out for them whatsoever. They're split between two Montana counties. with no town government. And they, a friend of mine, I got a lot of reaction from my article, and someone texted me a photo of employee housing in Big Sky that was three twin beds crammed into one hotel room with a hot plate. So, I mean, I wouldn't, even when I was the biggest ski bum, which I was at one point, I would have never kept that job. I would have been like, I'm out. Why am I working during the day for like $10 an hour and living in this like wretched tiny place? But that's what people are expected to put up with if they want to be part of this dream. And those are the people that the resorts depend on to make it run. So,
yeah,
those are just observations. And obviously there are also people living in tents in the woods. People there are also very, very afraid to go on the record about anything that's making their life miserable there. I think they're having a really tough time. And it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, whether or not they keep trying to maintain some kind of standard for their ski-like employees, or if they just move completely to outsourced labor, which I think would really decline the quality of a ski trip for anyone.
But
people who don't ski, don't care about skiing, they've been there for one season and that's it.
But is it fair to blame the affordable rental housing crunch on Vail and Alterra? I mean, do we blame it on property owners that are now renting their homes out instead of long-term rentals? They see the opportunity to make some money on Airbnb or VRBO or something.
Of course, yeah. You can't blame it on them entirely. That is what I also, I mentioned that in my opinion piece. But they're not helping. They're making it much worse. They are adding a lot of pressure onto something that was already very strained. And, yeah, of course, greedy property owners are another problem, but that's where a small, your local government really, in all these little towns, really has to step it up. Because that sort of aligns with the idea of over-tourism in a lot of popular places. It's the same issue, just over-tourism for a different reason. These are skiers instead of sightseers. But a lot of towns have had, and major cities even, a huge loss of residential housing because of a huge influx of visitors, and they've had to instill some really severe restrictions. And little ski towns haven't done that yet, but I think that they may need to if they hope to keep their towns functioning and not just I did refer to the small towns as company towns. If you just outline everything around what the large company needs, it's probably not the best thing for your community as a whole.
So my understanding is Jackson's busiest season is in the summer. How did this change? Or was it just because it was concentrated at the resort or the tram line or something?
For us, I think it is the concentration. Summer is vastly busier here. There's a ton of park traffic that comes through here. I think it was just the quality of people skiing was going down, and everyone is on a two-lane road that's littered with wildlife, moose, deer, elk, not to mention, small game. There was a lot of roadkill. It was a sad winter for us, really. The more cars on the road, more animals are killed. We're on the edge of one of the last functioning intact ecosystems in the northern zone of the globe, and you're just bringing in people, a lot of ICON, not to totally blame the ICON pass holders, but they drive. Of course they drive. They're road tripping. And they may not be aware of the wildlife. And it was a hard winter for us. It was a hard winter for the wildlife. We had a lot of roadkill. There was a lot of crowding. I mean, I guess on the bright side is when the traffic was at a 5-mile-an-hour pace the entire way from the resort to town, the wildlife were safe because the cars were going so slow. But there were still a lot more cars on the road and a lot of crowding. And we do have a problem with illegal Airbnbs and rentals taking away from residential housing, which is only becoming worse.
Yeah. You close your article by recommending that skiers support non-company resorts. What do you suggest for people here in Park City? We don't really have a choice at this point.
I don't know what I would support for us, I mean, if, for example, if Altera was to somehow acquire Jackson, you're stuck. This is your home. You're raising your family here, or your job is here, your business. So I'm sorry, I don't have a solution for Park City or for Jackson. I think, yeah, say you live in Denver, if you don't want to be a part of what you see as your fun ski vacation at the expense of the happiness of people who live in ski towns, the expense of their way of life, then yeah, bypass the Monarch, go to Silverton. Like, these are amazing independent resorts that have a lot to offer skiers.
Okay, I'm going to leave it there.
And they don't.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, like, the money that they make also stays closer to home, whereas the money you pay for your big pass into big resorts leaves. It goes to corporate headquarters in Broomfield and Denver. It's out. It's not local money.
Okay, I need to leave it there. Bridget, people will post the link to your article, the giant resort companies. Actually, the Mega Season Pass is killing skis, and it was written by Bridget Mander. Appreciate your time this morning with us.
All right. Thank you, Leslie.
It's 8:33 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, as we've reported, through a mutually agreed on condemnation, a parcel of land was donated to the North Summit Fire District on which to build a new fire station in Tollgate Canyon. In the studio with details, I have from the fire district spokesman, Tyler Rouser. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, talk a little bit about this friendly condemnation to bring it about.
Yeah, so this has been in the works for some time now. Since the fire district annexed Tollgate into its fire district, I believe back in 2014 is when that happened. There was a need recognized there, and since that time, there's been a lease agreement. We've been leasing some space up there from the HOA to house some equipment in the area. It's a very remote community, so, you know, getting to there from Colville or from Wanship even is timely, and in our business, seconds count, so having people close by there to quickly respond is the key with this.
Yeah. Did last summer's fire make this easier to do?
You know, it's been a process going on. You know, the HOA has been really good to work with the fire district. They see the value in it from the very beginning. And this is kind of through all the back and forth with attorneys, this was the final solution as to how they had to acquire this property.
Okay, so where's the station going to be located?
It's in the about the mid-mountain area, just up by the HOA's shop where they have their equipment. It's just about 3 acres in that area.
Okay, well, talk to us a little bit about what that fire station will look like. What will you have there?
You know, we'll have basic rescue equipment there, like we do now. Wildland, urban interface, and medical equipment. Right now, I don't believe the county is committing to putting an ambulance up there, but as the fire district is a first response agency for medical as well, we'll have our equipment to render aid to those in need up there quickly.
So will it be staff full time?
It will not. It'll be volunteers up there that will staff that. But we have a pretty good community up there that's, you know, rallied around to help to make sure that they're protecting their own community and helping their neighbors.
Okay, so when is it scheduled to be built? This summer?
So, you know, the key was getting this ground. At this point, they haven't designed a fire station yet. They've had some concepts that they've looked at. So I believe during this next summer, next winter, they will do that, get that through that process. So what would that be, 2020, they could possibly be breaking ground in the spring then.
Yeah. And who's paying for it?
The fire district, through their tax levy, will do it. They've been setting money aside in preparation for this, knowing since about 2014 that we would be building something up there. You know, we've been trying to diligently set money aside to not have to go into any type of debt for it.
Yeah, what have you budgeted for it?
You know, I don't have the exact budget numbers right now, yeah.
Okay. So it's still a volunteer district, even with all of the growth, huh?
Yeah, our growth is continuing. Right now it's still volunteer. We do have paid on-call people 24 hours a day. You know, we are seeing, you know, our call volume increase over the years, so... now that we are working with the county in, you know, being an EMS response agency as well, that's really boosting up those calls. But we're seeing the time savings to getting to patients much faster as well. So
these paid on-call people, do they only get paid if they respond, or are they paid just to be on-call?
They're paid to be on-call, be ready.
So do you see that changing, though, given the growth?
I'm sure, like everything else, as growth happens, you know, we'll have to reevaluate and go forward with that.
Yeah. So what about water up there?
You know, Tollgate has a very nice water system. They upgraded their system actually before it came into the fire district. They saw the need for it, and they have a very well-run water company up there that actually ties in with Mountain Regional even. So, you know, if water demands are higher than they can do, that there is ability to work with Mountain Regional and pull from their system as well.
Yeah, are there hydrants?
There are fire hydrants up there, yes.
Okay, but whether or not they're ready to go, do we know? I mean,
they are ready to go. We have used them in the past. A couple years ago, we had a house fire up there that we had to use them, and they worked really well.
If you had had this station last year, how would it have helped dealing with that fire?
Our equipment that is staged up there now, they responded to it. So this station, is the temporary situation we have right now is, we have equipment up there. They'll continue to be able to respond to these fires and help. So,
yeah, that was really just, lucky, right? Luck that it, the winds were blowing in the right direction.
It was
something, as I recall, a truck hitting a boulder, causing a spark setting.
Yeah. We're seeing this more often that, it doesn't take much to start these fires once that grass, dries out. It was in the time of day when the winds were blowing, and, one thing we can't control is nature. And so that's, one of the variables of our job that we have to constantly be dealing with is what is the weather doing, what is nature doing to help us or hindering us.
Yeah. Was that boulder removed, by the way?
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about what happened with the Echo Canyon fire. That took place in early September.
Yeah, so that was another one of those fires. Again, time of day, winds, those are all variable factors that we're having to deal with. I think one of the big takeaways is we lost no structures last year with any of our wildfires that we had, the big ones or small ones.
Yeah. So counting this new Tollgate station, how many stations will you have scattered throughout the district?
With this Tollgate station, we'll have four fire stations throughout the district.
Okay. And then in terms of volunteer staff, how many?
25 to 30 right now. And currently, we are hosting a Firefighter 1, Firefighter 2 class for volunteers. And that's conjunction with the Utah Fire and Rescue Academy, and South Summit and Wasatch County are also participating in that class. So
how does that work?
We're hosting it at our fire station in Colville, but the Fire and Rescue Academy provides all the instructors, all the props to do live burning and that, to get real life training. And then, these volunteers are volunteering their time to come and take this class and make sure that they're trained properly and ready to go for their communities.
So can anyone sign up, or anyone who wants to be a volunteer firefighter? Is that how it works?
Yeah, so anyone that's signed up to be a volunteer firefighter can take this class. It's kind of a every couple of years that we'll put one on. We have to have enough students, that there's a certain requirement to have enough students for the academy to come up and do this.
Okay. And do we have folks in Tollgate deputized, that could actually serve as firefighters?
Yes, we do. We have firefighters, emergency medical responders up there. Our fire chief lives up in Tollgate, so there's people up there.
Yeah. And so in terms of the district, what's your wish list?
A functional fire station up there is, our wish list. We're not going for a glorified building. We just want the basics to be able to provide for the citizens.
And in terms of the outlook then for this wildfire season, of course, things very wet.
Yeah, things are very wet. Again, it's going to go back to nature. What is it going to give us? Are we going to have a hot summer, hot, dry summer? Are we going to have a wet summer? That's going to be the major variable for us as to how wildland fire season looks going into 2019.
Okay. Anything else, Tyler, you wanted to mention?
I think just if you are living in these wildland urban interfaces like Tollgate, give us a call. Let's look at putting up prevention zones for you so that we can have that buffer for your homes to helpfully prevent any wildfires.
All right. How do they reach you?
They can call the fire district at 336-2221 or our website at northsummitfire.org.
Okay. Hey, Tyler, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
It's Tyler Rouser, the spokesman for the North Summit Fire District. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. 8:45 now. Good morning. Well, in the studio with an update from Park City Education Foundation, I have Foundation Director Abby McNulty along with Associate Director Jen Bello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Abby, let's start with you. You were nominated to be on the Industry Leadership Council for the National School Foundation Association. Tell me a little bit what that association is and what it does.
The National School Foundation Association is an organization that works to support education foundations across the country. And some of its recent work is putting into place standards and best practices for how ed foundations can work to support students in their communities.
Okay. Now, you were selected to be on this council because Park City Ed's Education Foundation considered one of the top education foundations in the country. How so?
That's right. It's pretty exciting. Because the Park City Education Foundation raises a significant amount of money for students in Park City School District. And so if you look at it per student for the size of our district, we are one of the top 10 in the country.
And that just is indicative of our average median income, if you will, as opposed to other, I'm guessing, smaller districts? Or is it because of the practices that you use to raise the funds?
I think it's because of our practices and who we are as an organization, and also because of this amazingly generous and supportive community. But no one wants to support an organization that's not doing the work that they say that they, you know, are intending to do. So I think it's all the things that you mentioned. You know, what's interesting, too, is in our community, we don't have large corporations. So we rely heavily on individual families and parents to support the schools, which is very different from, say, an urban setting or from other communities that have a large corporate presence. So we're very unique, actually, in the way we do our business.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, you're part of this subcommittee that's developing these best practices. What are some of those?
So there's a whole slew of best practices. And again, so Ed Foundations, even though the Park City Education Foundation has been around for 32 years, I probably have a phone call once a month with a director that's just starting their Ed Foundation in whatever part of the country that they're launching. So we have a long history and tradition, but as we see, public education funding is always questionable across the country. There's always challenges with public ed funding. Ed foundations are popping up everywhere. And as they pop up, the goal of this best practices and standards is to say, you know, we've been doing this for 30 to 50 years. You know, let's put some roadmaps in place for new ed foundations as they're getting launched. And also, you know, for us, even as an organization, the Ed Foundation, to look at what we're doing and benchmark against these best practices. So there's different categories. There's a category of programs, and for example, a best practice under program is that an education foundation should support and invest in the professional development of educators. Educators are the number one impact on students in the classroom. And so, you know, what that's saying is just invest in your educators. Makes sense. Other areas where they outline best practices are purpose. You know, who are your core stakeholders? What are the expectations for engaging your stakeholders? Advocacy, things like that. Also, fund development and gift stewardship. The role that Ed Foundations play in districts is to serve as a convener, investing funds. And then legal governance. So pretty basic operating principles, but the goal is to raise the profile of Ed Foundations around the country.
So in terms of what Park City does to invest in our educators, of course, we've got the teacher grants and we've got that story, ideas to impact.
Yeah.
How else do you invest in educators, do you think?
Well, we also have our Excellent Educators Express every year. This year, it's April 26th, and it honors best educators in every school. And then we also provide professional development funds. For example, coding is a relatively new initiative in the school district supported by the Ed Foundation. And what we've been able to do is through private gifts really support very deep, meaningful professional development for the educators who are on the front lines of the coding program. So they've visited school districts in Washington State, in California, in Illinois, because the coding is a brand new program, not a lot of resources online. And to be able to get into the classrooms of where these programs are happening and talk to the teachers who have been on the front lines too is very meaningful. So that's one example.
Yeah. So do other foundations provide the breadth of offerings that Park City does? You do a lot.
Yeah, we do. That's why I think we're one of the best ones in the country, frankly. I think we're ahead of the pack, honestly. We do a lot to support the public schools in this community. And I get phone calls all the time for Ed Foundations wanting to be like us after they want to be like us when they grow up. So.
All right. Well, one of those programs, of course, is the Elementary Visual Arts Program that I know the Ed Foundation has helped for a while. Jen, what's going on with that? And maybe just tell us a little bit about the history about that, why that was even started.
Yeah, sure. So years and years ago, the state of Utah took elementary art out of the curriculum. So, considered not necessary. But if we all think about, especially young kids and not getting art education, that just seems completely wrong. And studies show that it is, that there's all kinds of things that come from an art background, creativity, there's actually problem solving. Kids who might not do well in a real structured environment can do really well in art. So it's a place where they can succeed. And so what we saw is there was a lot of parent-taught art programs, and those waxed and waned depending on the, volunteers, right? So some years there would be a really dedicated person in charge. And, you think about there's 30 to 40 classrooms at each of our schools, and trying to get all those volunteers, it was a lot. So I think it was McPullen that asked for a grant for funds to cover a part-time art teacher and some of the supplies. And we did that, and it was very successful, and that was in 2011. And it kind of grew from there, and there were other parents in the Kimball Arts Center wanted to help as well, where people were going, this really needs to be part of the curriculum. I think at Trailside then, there was a grant there, and then finally Parley's Park. And then all the entities came together to form the Elementary Visual Art Program. And the Kimball, with their expertise in the art background, wrote the curriculum, grade K through 5, and then the Ed Foundation funded the art teachers. And what's been really exciting to see that grow is at Parley's, for instance, now, that teacher is a full-time teacher in the specialist rotation with the music teacher and the PE teacher and the life skills teacher. And that's what the Parley's parents wanted. They were so excited to see what art was doing for their kids. And the teachers were also won over when they would see the art teacher taking the, whatever lesson they might be working on, whether it's in language arts or math, and incorporating it into art. It became part of the fabric of life at Parley. So that teacher's full time, and we cover through our donors, we cover the cost there. So it's been really exciting to see that growth.
Yeah. So our curriculum was cut because of cost. That's why the state did it, or they just don't think it's necessary. Or do
Abby might have to answer that one.
I think it goes back to the fact that the state of Utah is the lowest funded education system in the country, and so they're providing funding for a minimum offering essentially, and so anything above and beyond comes from local tax dollars or from the Park City Education Foundation.
Hmm. And I guess I just really haven't ever seen any pushback on that. As a result, it's like if we're growing and we've got more money, I mean, why is that something that's not being brought back?
Art.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think if you look at a lot of letters to the editor and editorials in the Salt Lake Trib lately about how, even though the economy in the state of Utah is growing, funding for education is not. So that's a bigger question and conversation. We think art is incredibly important, and that's why we continue to fund it year after year.
Okay. Let's see. Running with Ed. That's happening in about a month.
Yes. Yeah, so part of the way we fund these programs, of course, is through events like Running with Ed. And we love this event because our whole community can take part. It is May 18th. The last day for regular registration is April 17th. So it's a week from Wednesday. So I know people are on spring break, but if they think about it while they're laying on the beach, you can register online or when you get back. And you want to do that because there's the $5,000 Park City Mountain grant that your school can win for the highest registration. This year's the 10th anniversary. There's going to be lots of fun things through the schools. It's just this, again, great day, great community event. And we raise $250,000 that we absolutely have to cover these programs like, you know, EVA, the nearly 100 programs that we cover. So we hope when everyone gets back, they'll register, and lots of fun things in store for the 10th anniversary.
Yeah, how's the registration looking? You doing okay?
Yeah, it looks really good. There's more kids than ever, which is exciting for us. We really made a push starting a couple years ago to get kids involved. You know, it's Park City, and parents are like, well, my kid can run the, you know, short leg, the 1.8 mile between Jeremy Ranch and Ecker. But what's amazing, I did the leg where you go up the UOP steps, except I took the chairlift, but don't tell anybody. But anyway, what I would see is the little kids would just take off running up these stairs. And so the parents were going, I don't want to run up the UOP steps, but my 8-year-old does. So I think that's been a really fun thing for us to see is the growth of the kids in the race.
Yeah. Also coming up this month, we're expected to see some options revealed to the Park City Board of Education through this master planning process. Was the Ed Foundation involved in any of that?
Yes. So both me and Kara Cody, who's our programs director, sat in on one of the master planning meetings throughout the course. So we weren't on the task force. We were on one of the subcommittees.
Yeah. I mean, what, any input or from you in particular? Or?
I thought it was a really great experience. I really enjoyed it. We participated in the Learning Leaders, I believe it was called. And so we sat with the educators and participated in that way. I thought it was really enlightening, very interesting. I loved the conversation. And I look forward to seeing what the options are that come back on the 16th.
Okay. Anything else, guys?
That's it.
All right. Abby McNulty and Jen Bellow from the Park City Education Foundation. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie.
Listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW.